This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street radio show all across North Dakota this time of day. Our show today begins with a discussion with Marcus Lavoy. He is from our part of the world, but he is living in Los Angeles these days because he's become an actor. And he is a featured performer with a major role in Chambers, which is a new horror series that debuts on Netflix this Friday. He joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Marcus, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be on the show.
How would you describe this new Netflix horror series, Chambers?
Chambers is deemed a teen horror drama, but really there's so many different elements that come into play on it. I mean, there's these two families from opposite sides of the tracks. One is a rich, affluent family. The other, my family, is Native American and the poorer side of town. And we come together through these very unique and extreme circumstances. My niece on the show, who's played by Savan Rose, who's a phenomenal first-time actor, who's just going to blow you guys away. She did such a fantastic job. She has a bad heart, and at 17 years old, she has a heart attack, gets a heart transplant from this rich family, and the heart turns out to be possessed. So all of this crazy storyline, 10 episodes on Netflix, airing this Friday, starts to unfold from this possessed heart.
And you are big Frank Yazzie, the uncle of this lead character, right?
That's correct. Big Frank Yazzie. Yes, sir.
Is this your first Netflix role?
Absolutely, yes. First Netflix, yes.
How does it compare with your previous work?
Well, what I really want to say and I love about Netflix is they're just this great company that is kind of pioneering and spearheading this new type of TV shows and films that are very culturally diverse. They're bringing cultural awareness to the communities, and they're emphasizing equality, and especially with our show, you know, to be a Native American man on this show it's just such an honor, because for the first time ever, we're not necessarily being portrayed in the classic realm of, you know, riding around on horses, shooting arrows into people. We are everyday people living everyday lives who, as I said, are caught up in these very extreme circumstances.
Well, you mentioned that diversity is being promoted, and it is. The show is promoting it this is being a horror story, but it's also promoting the fact that it has this diverse cast. It includes Native Americans representing Navajo, right?
Yes, absolutely. The Navajo Nation is represented in this. We shot out in Arizona and New Mexico, which, by the way, is a fantastic area. Had no idea. We were out in Albuquerque for, I want to say, maybe 6 months, and such beautiful terrain and wonderful places to shoot, great sets to shoot out there on. And the people out there were so fantastic and warm and welcome. You know, I've shot many different TV shows and films over the years, and I got to say, Albuquerque was just, the people out there were so warm and friendly and welcoming to us. It was a really nice change.
Well, let's talk about your journey from the White Earth Reservation in northwest Minnesota to Los Angeles. Connect the steps for us. How did you get there?
Well, I was born in Minnesota, and my parents lived with my parents, and they divorced at a pretty young age, early age. And so I left with my mother and moved to California. Lost track with my Native American culture, my family back in Minnesota. And it was funny because lived out here in California for many, many years. I was married, still married, been married for 26 years. And I was married, and my wife 1 year for my birthday, unbeknownst to me, hired as a private investigator to locate my family back in Minnesota. And did so, and my dad contacted me, and a little bit hesitant at first. You know, it had been a lot of years. There was a little some unresolved feelings there. But once we got together, it was like, you know, God literally restored the time. And we are so close now. And I have a brother out there and two sisters and a bunch of nieces and cousins and a beautiful family. And we've been reunited. So I'm starting to learn more about my culture and my past. And it has been a fantastic journey.
Do you return to White Earth?
Yes, I have. We were back there, I want to say, maybe 2 years ago now. We went back in the summer once, went back in the winter, trying to, you know, see the different seasons back there. Prefer the summer to the winter.
There you go.
That was a little much.
well, you live in La La Land now. Let's talk
exactly.
About
we don't get much snow out here.
This transition. What were you doing before you got into show business?
Started out military, then I went into law enforcement, and with the Department of Corrections down in San Diego, then transitions into the sheriff's department. I did some work with the San Diego County Sheriff's. And, I was doing some, how I got transitioned into acting from the law enforcement aspect was I was off duty and I was doing some security work, you know, part-time security work on the side, some extra bucks, working on a set down there. One of the studios, they had a studio down in San Diego. And I was just kind of doing some set security, sitting around watching the security of the set. And they were like, hey, do you want to step in and do a small role? I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. That led to one thing, that led to the next. And it was some little small speaking roles. Fell in love with it. And here we are. Been 18 years now I've been pursuing the acting thing. So,
and now you're working with two very well-known performers in Chambers, this Netflix horror series that drops on Friday, Uma Thurman and Tony Goldwyn. So what's it like to be on set with those folks?
You know, I got to say, I have, you know, I've worked with some pretty big celebrities in the past, but I got to tell you, these two were hands down some of the best people in the industry that I have come across. And I honestly mean that. I mean, Uma Thurman was so, you know, there's a lot of new casts on there. There's a lot of younger casts that said it's kind of a teen horror genre is how they promoted it, but so many other elements. Uma Thurman was so willing to kind of go above and beyond and work with the cast, the younger cast. She made herself available. She was friendly and taught them. And I was really impressed by that. You know, she's been in the industry a little while now, and she has every right to not be that way, but her and Tony were quite the opposite, just so warm and friendly, and it was a really nice change to be around that.
I was
dealing with some big celebrities like that.
Yeah, you've got these young beginning actors in some cases with somebody as experienced as Uma is with a camera. Did she give some good tips?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we had a scene one time in the trailer, and we had a pretty heated scene where it's a pretty emotional scene. And she said, well, let's run the scene. And I said, okay, let's run it. So we ran it a few times, and she goes, now let's yell at each other. Just scream the scene at me. And so we raised our voice to the top, you know, octave, yelled back and forth. And she goes, okay, now let's whisper it. So we brought it way back down, and then we kept running it. And somewhere in between, we found this wonderful cohesiveness, and we nailed it, and we got it. And it went down without a hitch. So little tricks like that of the trade were fantastic.
Now, you're playing a Navajo. Are there tribal distinctions that are reflected in the character, the performance that you make?
Well, once again, I mean, Netflix did such a fantastic job. They brought out some tribal elders from the Navajo Nation out there. And, yeah, there's distinctions in clothing and hairstyles. And, I mean, they were really on point with, you know, making sure that we weren't being offensive in any way or insulting any of the different tribes. And I hope that we brought honor. And I just really hope we did a good thing here, and respectful thing and honorable thing here in representing the nations out there.
Now, you've worked in TV soaps, the TV fantasy series Power Rangers Time Force, and primetime series like CSI Miami. So you're getting quite a reel put together here, Marcus.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I also have a show airing the 24th. I'm not sure the time, Central, East, I don't know how that works, but on WGN America, a TV show called Gone, were about FBI agents who track down cases of children abducted. And I played Grant Rowland on that show, Native American guy who basically works off the reservation, checking on the welfare of children adopted off the reservation.
Gone is airing tonight.
Please check that out as well.
Your resume includes stunt work and work with weapons and hand-to-hand combat. Give us a little bit of your background there.
Well, like I said, from some military training to law enforcement training, I was a firearms instructor, worked with many different kinds of firearms, and I also hand-to-hand combat and tactical combat training with weapons and weaponless self-defense. So I've had quite a long career of kind of the tough guy roles, and it's really helped nicely from my background training to kind of transition into doing stunt work. I always do all my own fight work, always do my own stunts to some degree. I mean, I'm not going to jump out of like a 20-story building, but definitely love doing the fight scenes and anything that's kind of, you know, hand-to-hand combat. I love all that.
And that is all very carefully choreographed for the camera. It takes some time to get it set, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's always, you know, high safety concerns on the set when you're doing any kind of stunt work. You have a team of stunt coordinators around there. Yeah, and then it's a repetition of it. I mean, even in Chambers, we had a little scene that you'll see, I believe, in episode 6. And you know, once it's edited and cut, it doesn't look like much. But when you're in there doing it and you're getting thrown down on these tiny little mats on a cement surface 10, 15 times, it starts to, you know, a few times the fall goes wrong and you pay the price. So, yeah, you definitely have to experience it a few times.
Well, have you had more than a bruise from doing this?
Yeah, I broke a thumb one time in a fight scene. I chipped a bone in my elbow another time in a fight scene. I sprained an ankle one time in a scene. So, yeah, I've had some little scrapes and bruises, but absolutely nothing serious.
You mentioned that you've played a lot of roles as tough guys. Are you concerned about being typecast?
No, I mean, I think I would love that's kind of my genre. I love the action films. I would ideally love to be in some epic battle scene, swinging an axe on some battlefield somewhere.
An Avenger.
You know, but I think too that you also have to see that, you know, after being in the industry a while, you start to develop, you know, hopefully you start to develop some acting skills outside of just the tough guy stuff. And, you know, I believe I put a lot of hard work in. I've trained in my craft, been in classes for many, many years. And I'm starting to develop some skills now that are going to promote my acting ability, not as much as just the tough guy. I mean, you get this wheelhouse of knowledge, and hopefully that portrays on the screen.
What is your goal as a performer?
I would just say to continue working. I love film. I love television. And I want to kind of go into some roles where, you know, I can really show some acting skills. I can show some chops. I can show that, you know, I have a depth of emotion and feeling that goes into my character. I study very diligently when I take on a character. If I get a character, no matter what the role is, I do a full background on this character. I go over his childhood. I go over his victories, his losses, and I make up this whole elaborate story based on this character. And those subtleties, I believe, are what starts to portray in the character on film. Even if they're unspoken, I know them, I know they're there, and I know who this character is. So when a director will take me down a different road, I can always respond accordingly because I know the core of that character.
I was reading a little bio on you, and I came across this interesting note here. You're very proud of your work with the Christian-based Eastern Sky Theater Company. Tell us about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. It's funny because as an actor, especially living in L.A., you need to be available during the daytime for auditions. That's just the nature of the beast. So what do you do to support and take care of a family? Well, in my case, with my background, I'd work at nightclubs here in L.A. because they're open, you know, all night long. You can make decent money and pay your bills and leave days open for auditioning. Well, having said that, now you're at a nightclub till 3, 4, or 5 in the morning. And on the weekends, I would get off at, say, 4 or 5 in the morning, go home, shower, lay down for an hour or so, and get up. And on a Sunday, drive all over Los Angeles from Anaheim down to Southern California, all the way back up, and we'd perform in these Christian plays with my theater company, performing different variations of different plays. And I got so much joy and honor out of, you know, performing, first of all, live. I believe that's where I developed some good acting skills. And just to be able to give back to the people and to just represent God and my faith. And it was such an honor. Some of the very best memories as an actor I have are with my theater company, Eastern Sky.
So Eastern Sky, does it produce its own scripts or does it publish scripts? How does it work?
Oh, no, they definitely write their own scripts. Trey Fernald is the CEO of it all and our pastor. And he's a wonderful man of God. And we have a film out called The Last Appeal. And it can be purchased in, I believe, Walmart, The Last Appeal. And it's about 5 inmates on death row. And I play one of those 5. And it is a story about second chances and redemption and forgiveness. Very, very powerful film. And although it didn't go to theaters, they didn't want to put it in theaters. He didn't want to put it in theaters because there are some countries around the world that can't afford to go sit in a movie theater. So we went with a TV option and DVD option in hopes that it could reach more people and masses. And it's, to date, I think over 30 million people have seen the film. So I strongly encourage you to go check it out, The Last Appeal.
All right. And you can search for it under Eastern Sky Theater Company as well. Marcus Lavoie plays Big Frank Yazzie in Chambers, which debuts on Netflix this Friday. And Marcus, you mentioned that you did 10 episodes, so you know how this ends. But the whole Netflix thing, the streaming, has changed the way people watch TV too, hasn't it? They can watch it once in a while, or they can watch all 10 of them.
Yeah, and I think that one of the wonderful things about Netflix is this whole streaming aspect. First of all, it takes pressure off us as actors about ratings and about this and that. You go out there, you film, you give it everything you have. And I can say that for the cast of Chambers. We were out there 6 months in Albuquerque and away from our families. We're out there working. And I can honestly say I saw every last character on there give 1,000% to their performances. Nobody cut corners. Everybody put everything into it. And I believe that it shows in the final product. I really do. I'm proud of it. I'm honored to be a part of it. And yeah, the whole Netflix thing with the streaming live, you can pause it. You can watch 10 episodes and binge watch it all in one night. You can watch two. You know, it gives you the variety of choice. And I think that's a great way to watch TV series nowadays.
Marcus Lavoie in Chambers on Netflix. Again, it debuts Friday, April 26th, and all the way from White Earth to Los Angeles. Thank you for speaking with us today, Marcus.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being on your show.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Do you subscribe to a streaming service like Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon Prime? The list of subscription services has grown to 300, and it's still growing. Frustration is also growing among consumers as they add up the costs of streaming. Jeff Laux is the executive director for Deloitte's Center for Technology, Media, and Telecom. He recently joined Tanzina Vega on Public Radio's The Takeaway to talk about subscription frustrations and what companies can do to combat them.
When it comes just to video subscriptions, they have an average of 3. But what we found in our survey is that people aren't just subscribing to video services. They're also subscribing to gaming and music, and they're piecing it all together. And this is giving them unprecedented freedom to choose for themselves what they watch, the music they listen to, and the games that they play.
So that doesn't sound like a negative thing, but your research has found that there were some complaints that people had about these streaming services.
Well, what they love is the freedom to choose among these different services. And in fact, there are 300 streaming video services alone to choose from. So they like having the choice. The problem is managing all these subscriptions and the hassles of finding what they want to watch or what they want to listen to. And just juggling all of it. That's the part that they don't like, but they love the freedom.
When I think about cable and I think about premium channels like HBO and Showtime and all these channels that that then seem to multiply, then there was ESPN, ESPN2, and beyond. Is that what's happening with digital streaming services?
In a way, yes. The difference with cable was that everything was under one subscription. So all these different channels would pop up, but then you had a single subscription. The difference is that as these new offerings came on board, you were paying more and more for your cable subscription. But here's the difference now. A lot of times people are subscribing to a new service because it's a show or a movie or something that they can't get anywhere else. We found that 57% of those who subscribe to a streaming service, they picked a service because they wanted to watch something that they couldn't get anywhere else. But what's happening now is that there are lots of separate services that people are subscribing to get to this content that they really like, instead of it being under one big subscription. And that is the source of a lot of the discontent right now.
Well, and then I'm wondering, I'm sure there are other Americans who are like me who might do that thing. They might subscribe to a service because they really want to see that one particular show and then forget that they're subscribed and then just keep paying for that service. Does that happen? Is that part of the frustration?
That is part of the frustration. And I think a lot of it is just, you know, having a subscription for a limited reason, right? You want it for a particular show or set of shows, and then maybe the back catalog that you valued, there's less and less on it. So, for example, a couple of years ago, if you subscribed to a streaming service, there were a lot of different shows and movies that were in the back catalog. But now, a lot of studios and networks are going forward with their own services, and they're pulling the rights to that content from the services. So you might have a streaming subscription that used to cover lots of different shows and movies that you liked, and as the months and years go by, there's less and less other subscription services. So to get those now, you've got to have a whole new subscription. And that is definitely a source of frustration.
So what's happening? Are people, because people now have to follow the content, essentially, are they canceling their subscriptions because of those frustrations?
They're not canceling right now. But what we have found is that, you know, again, if you have a streaming subscription, you'll likely have about three of them. That was the same as last year. So what we're wondering is, as these new subscription services multiply, are they going to sign up for more? Or is it going to be, you know, people are going to have their top three, maybe four, and then there's a lot of competition to get into those three or four slots?
Part of what's happening, too, is, as you said, people are chasing the show, right? So they're interested in that episode or that particular program or that star. And it's really splitting the experience for a lot of people. Like, I will make it an admission here, I'm sure as half of the world has, that I have not watched Game of Thrones, but I do feel like I've lost something in that process. Are we losing something culturally because of all of these streaming services and the content available on them?
Well, that's one perspective. You know, if you don't sign up for a particular service, and you're missing a big cultural phenomenon, you may feel like you're missing out. But I think what's driving a lot of streaming right now is that people have a fear of missing out, and that's why they're getting so many subscription services. You know, they want to watch a particular thing on this service and that service and the other service so they don't miss out when people are talking about it at the bar or at the water cooler. And the question is, how many of these are they willing to have in order to kind of see these must-see TV shows that used to be under one big bundle?
What's interesting is that someone suggested, well, why don't, you know, if you can't figure out which streaming service it's on, why not just Google the name of the show? And I thought, well, that's extra work for me, right? Shouldn't I just be able to know where the show is?
It is extra work, and it's one of those things that is causing a lot of friction for consumers. You know, why should I have to manage this when I'm paying for all of it? But what I think may end up happening soon is that there may be more people using voice assistants in order to keep track of this. You're seeing some early adopters doing this now where they might have, you know, a streaming service attached to a voice assistant. They may be able to say, hey, assistant, you know, find me Game of Thrones or what have you. And then it will come up.
In order to create content, companies, they have to put money behind it. And I'm wondering if that means subscribers are going to end up paying more. It's not cheap to create television, to create shows.
That's right. You know, when you start spending billions or, you know, tens of billions of dollars in content, eventually you're going to have to raise your prices. And I think you're starting to see that as well. One thing that we are going to see more of is ad-supported streaming, where you don't have to sign up and it doesn't cost you X dollars a month, but you're trading your attention for the content sitting through ads. So that I think we're going to see more of.
Kind of what we're doing on YouTube, for example.
Exactly.
Jeff Laux is the executive director for Deloitte's Center for Technology, Media, and Telecom. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Tanzina Vega, host of The Takeaway. Coming up, Harvest Public Media looks at a farm program to help migratory birds, and we'll share a cutting-edge podcast about service learning. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The legislature has given its support to a proposed Theodore Roosevelt Library and Museum to be built at Medora. The funding plan passed as part of Governor Burgum's budget. It provides $50 million for an endowment. $15 million would be in general fund dollars, and $30 million comes from a Bank of North Dakota loan. That money will be used to match $100 million in private donations. Hazen Republican Representative Bill Twite spoke in favor on the House floor.
This is a one-time opportunity. I don't want to stand here 5 years from now or have my grandchildren 50 years from now regret that we didn't do this.
But Fargo Republican Representative Tom Kading didn't want state money involved in a project like this.
This is a want, not a need. If people want to willingly donate, we should let them. but we should not force them.
The bill passed 76 to 16. The North Dakota Department of Human Services has been working to create efficiencies to reduce turnaround time for fingerprint background checks for child care workers. A child care worker is required to submit fingerprints and a background check before working with children. They used to be able to work under supervision until their submissions were approved, but a federal law passed in 2014 and implemented in 2018 required those background checks to be completed before the workers could watch children. This created some issues with child care facilities, and the Human Services Department has been doing what it could to expedite that process. Amanda Carlson is Early Childhood Services Administrator with the department. She says starting in October of this year, the provisional employment period will return to North Dakota so workers can be employed and supervised on a probationary period while waiting for those background checks to be approved. And she says they've also been working on ways to speed up the approval process.
The criminal background check unit has been working with a group of stakeholders to include child care providers to find efficiencies that could be made with the background check process. And so we have implemented some of those. Some of them are still in the works. But our hope is that October 1, 2019, when the federal requirement for provisional employment goes back into effect, that employers will be and child care providers will be fully informed and aware of what needs to happen and be able to plan accordingly their employment and their plan for employment on prospective employees.
The efficiencies will also benefit other programs in areas that require background checks, such as foster care licensing, adoption, guardianship, and other child care and placement agencies. And the Senate has passed a bill that would provide an income tax credit for Social Security benefits. The law would take effect for years following the date of December 31, 2018. Republican Senator Jordan Kanyanen carried the bill on the Senate floor, saying he would not vote for the bill.
I could talk about the committee's philosophy of broad base and low rates, or I could talk about the fact that low-income individuals are already exempt from the payment of income taxes on their Social Security benefits. Instead of doing that, I'll just say that I'm personally voting no on this bill, but I'm not sure if there's anything that else I could say that would change anybody's mind at this point.
The bill passed on a vote of 36 to 11. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As prairie and grasslands gave way to farmland, habitat for birds and aquatic life disappeared. But what if there was a way to make space for native birds and give farmers a little extra cash in return? Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck looked into a program that's trying to do just that.
That's the sound of researchers trying to gently, or not so gently, put together a tower with antennas to help track birds. More specifically, track American golden plovers. It's a bird about the size of a Coke bottle on spindly legs, and it has one of the longest migrations of any bird, constantly on the move from Argentina up to the Arctic Circle. Ben Williams is leading plover research with the Illinois Natural History Survey and Prairie Research Institute, and he says the bird's stopover in central Illinois is important because they're fueling up to finish their trip north to breed. They need to eat a solid amount, or
they might not breed very well, or they'll have a failed nest, and then you start to see population numbers dip.
There's only a few hundred thousand of them total. It's a bird of conservation concern, meaning there's worries about its long-term survival, but there's not enough data to list it as threatened or endangered. Here's a research recording of what they sound like. William says a key habitat for the bird is shallow puddles and fields, which could help it get food like worms. And that happens to be habitat for other kinds of birds too, like ducks, geese, killdeer, sandpipers.
Greater and lesser yellowlegs, willets, and avocets. And there's a whole suite of bird species called shorebirds that like to wade in very shallow water or mud, kind of mudflat areas.
But those areas disappear when farmers use field tiles, that is, underground systems that help siphon water off of fields. Drier ground makes it easier to plant, grow crops, and work with heavy machinery. But shorebirds lose out. So there's the SCARCE program. That's Shorebird Conservation Acreage via Drainage Runoff Control Program. Oofta. It pays farmers to let water pool in their fields. It also helps pay to put in structures that keep that water from draining off. farmers just need to stop up water from February to mid-April, which is usually before they plant and when plovers migrate through. Generally, when the birds head north, farmers can lift the floodgates. Farmer Bruce Thompson, out near Allerton, Illinois, is a fan.
Glad that I could participate, and everything has been great.
Thompson gets paid for the few acres of water that pool on his property. For new participants, it's about $1,000 an acre, up to $5,000. Returning participants get half that. Another benefit is that stopped up water gives farmers' soil more time to soak up nitrogen, leaving less for waterways and more for his crops. Thompson can even use those water control structures to keep moisture in his fields if it gets dry in late summer. He also just likes birds.
Of course, we're all for birds. My wife is a bird watcher.
But who is paying for all of this? There's a bit from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, the University of Illinois, the National Audubon Society, and the National Resources Conservation Service. That last one, the NRCS, is a federal service that helps promote field practices like using cover crops or these water control structures. Those help keep nutrients, like nitrogen, in the soil so it doesn't get into streams and rivers, boosting harmful algal blooms and leading to a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. But like the fields themselves, the program funds could dry up in just a few years. And Kirk Stadola, an associate ornithologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, thinks this kind of conservation could stave off potential troubles down the line.
I think that there's so many uncertainties that you start to remove species or not care about what's out there, and that can lead to many unforeseen consequences that we don't know about right now.
Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, the Cutting Edge podcast looks at service learning.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years, but I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this Grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
Thank you for joining us today on Prairie Public for Main Street. Students in the small town of Center North Dakota are making big waves in their community thanks to service learning. That's when kids use what they learn in the classroom to help others. Nikki Dahl works in ag education, helping run an FFA chapter. And in 2018, Dahl's students were named finalists for the 2018 National Premier Chapter in Building Communities and Growing Leaders. To be eligible, students have to demonstrate competency in doing innovative things or taking traditional concepts and applying creative twists. Fewer than 1% of chapters are chosen for this honor each year. Dahl and two of her students, Tegan Henke and Shelby Meckley, spoke with Tom Gerhart of the Cutting Edge podcast.
And how did you get to that point where you realized service learning was a critical part of your job as a teacher and so important to the students and their learning environment?
It was definitely an accident. You know, you as an ag program, you always get called up by somebody in the community, asked to do something, and we're really bad at saying no. And so, you know, we said yes to one project a long time ago, and it's just snowballed from there. We've created these partnerships and these relationships with different organizations in our community and people, and we're dependable. And so they come to us to fulfill certain needs, and it's just snowballed from there. So we went from one project to tons of projects.
How did you get the community involved?
It started with them asking us to do projects, and then we would get crazy ideas, or usually me, and then I go to them and just say, hey, we should do this, and I don't wait long enough for them to tell me no, and then so we just do them. And so a lot of times it comes down to the students. We figure out who in the community would be an asset for those particular projects. Recently, we just held an ag day for the entire school, so you know, 100 plus kids came through our agriculture department to learn about agriculture education and the importance of agriculture. You know, we just have partnerships even in the community. The use of panels, we had people donate straw for the event. All these people bring in their animals for the whole day. You know, so it's just building up those partnerships. And then we send thank yous and publicize all these events. And when people are appreciated, they keep coming back.
And ladies, maybe you can tell me about some other projects, whether they're small in scale or some of the other things that you've been able to partner with in the community or the area.
We recently held a haunted school and we had the community come up and it was a really big outcome. We had like fun events planned for all the children. We had escape rooms that our ag teacher put on and yeah, a whole bunch of people came. So it was really cool just to know that our community was willing to come out. And
the proceeds from that, they made over $700 and they donated it to hurricane relief in North Carolina. Mm-hmm.
See, and when you have collaborations like that, you have to work with a lot of different people. Not everybody has the same ideas or comes from the same place. What does that teach you when you have to maybe give and take in some things and to arrive at common ground?
I think that really teaches you that everyone has their own opinion, obviously, and we just have to be able to work with everyone's opinion and be able to get everyone's opinion involved in those kind of projects and make sure we're all coming from the same place to reach the same goal.
Nikki, we've heard about the national convention, but just having some recognition on the national level, it's got to feel good. This is Center, North Dakota.
I was in an airport when I found out.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised they let me board the plane because I was jumping around and screaming because for North Dakota FFA in general, I think the last chapter to receive the honor was before I started teaching, so, you know, over 7.5 years ago. Less than 1% of chapters a year get recognized in that aspect, and we were recognized in two different areas. So we were top 10 for two different projects, and we love what we do because it makes an impact. The awards and the recognition is just a fringe benefit of that, and we enjoy the recognition and to put our little town of Center on the map and North Dakota FFA on the map, and it was really a team effort. On our way down there, it really felt like all the chapters in North Dakota were cheering us on.
How does it make you feel to know that the work you're doing here is recognized by others?
It's a lot different from activities like basketball or volleyball. We don't get that type of recognition. And so to be able to do it through FFA is kind of awesome. We have so many opportunities through FFA.
And Nikki, from your perspective, what kind of impact do you see that this community service has on kids like Tegan and Shelby?
One project we did was the Patriotic Puppy Campaign. So we teamed up with a Great Dane breeder in Underwood. She donated a Great Dane puppy to a veteran in New Mexico. So he drove up here to meet the kids. He did a huge assembly and we had like kids crying when he was speaking and he showed his purple heart. And I mean, his girlfriend was crying and the breeder was crying. And so, I mean, that's the power and that's the impact.
Yeah. I remember sitting in the bleachers while he was like giving his speech and just like thinking how amazing this was and like what we all did to be like to where we were at that point. And just seeing his face, like when he was holding the puppy, just like made us feel so happy. And like, we just knew we were doing a good thing. And that's what warmed our hearts.
The cool part is he's got a Facebook page now for Peanut and he shares stuff about how Peanut's growing. And so we always get to check in. And I mean, the partnership with that breeder, she's in like 10 days is going to have more puppies. And so we always live stream that. And so kids get to watch puppies be born. And I mean, just the endless opportunities that come from something so simple. I mean, it really only takes one person to create a ripple effect and have an impact across the world. So I think that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where you come from.
Yeah, exactly.
And what's better than a Great Dane named Peanut?
Yeah, that's nothing.
That's awesome. Tell me about the FFA motto, learning to do, doing to learn, earning to live, and living to serve.
I think that FFA motto just really shows what FFA is all about just through it because there's so many community service projects we're learning to do and we're doing to learn and we're just learning so many other things that we can give back to our community and other communities and just the world.
And Shelby, we heard Nikki say that one person can make an impact. It starts with one person. That's something I'm sure you've learned and seen now through all these projects.
Yes, like we've done so much and like we've given a lot, but we've also got a lot. Like our community is always there with us and they always show up to help us. And I don't know, it's really taught us that everyone can just help and join in on stuff. Yeah, we can have the idea, but we always have people out there willing to help, willing to give.
And the impact on the community would be substantial too, I would think, Nikki. Yeah. And I'm sure you're getting feedback too for the future and mm-hmm. on things, which is a really critical piece to learning too.
Well, when they keep calling me with more projects, you know, we're being successful and sometimes we have to learn to say no, but we've done small projects, building a playground, building benches to huge projects, you know, donating to hurricane relief. And I don't think it matters the size of the project or the money earned. It's those skills made throughout.
And when you look at the big picture and down the road, I think the kinds of things that are being instilled in your students right now will be things they can take with them for the rest of their lives and help make their communities and where they live better.
Definitely.
How important is that to instill that mindset at this age or even an earlier age, perhaps, so that people consider a broader picture than just themselves, let's say?
You know, it's always been argued that, you know, we're teaching a generation that isn't about giving, which I'd sit back and argue because I work with some pretty outstanding kids that always want to give, and they don't need anything back for that. But they're going to leave here. They're going to go to college or go to the workforce, and they're going to live someplace, and they're going to be involved in the community someplace. And so how can I, within my classroom, give them skills that it doesn't matter what major they do or it doesn't matter what job that they start with, that they're going to be successful? And that could be here at home in Center, when they move to Florida. I mean, it doesn't matter where they go. These skills are applicable.
You're also learning to get the word out and tell the world about what you're doing.
We have a Center FFA officer Facebook page, and we just have a Center FFA page. And we're constantly updating posts on there and posting what we do in our classrooms, like at competitions and stuff, and just letting our community know how we're doing, like what's coming up. And if they, like, they asked us to build benches, and we'd like post pictures out there about how they're coming along and stuff.
Tegan, we hear a lot about why social media is bad, but in this case, it sounds like this is can be a kind of a powerful tool for the work you're doing.
So many students have Facebook and Instagram in our school that aren't in FFA, and we like to show off what we're doing in FFA, so maybe get a better perspective about what we actually do in our chapter, and many other chapters also have their own social media.
And Nikki, just talk about using technology and implementing technology. And I've heard people say just because it's technology, it's how it's used that makes it valuable. Talk about what you've done here and how it's been effective.
Well, they use it better than I do. So, I mean, but just like the adopted Texas Classroom program, when we signed up for that, you know, our goal was to send supplies down to Houston, Texas, to a classroom in support of the hurricane last year. And we used the hashtag Adopt a Texas Classroom, which that was set up by the campaign. But it was really cool because now we can type that in and we can see all of the other people from around the nation that joined that project. And it creates a really cool timeline of the support given by just that project alone. I think where technology is going, social media is being used, businesses are using it a lot to market. And so I think it's important to teach them how to properly use it. And being creative and thinking outside the box and using what you have available and the strengths of my students, who can do what. And, you know, we use Snapchat videos sometimes to market different projects, you know, with the fun filters, and use what's at our disposal.
Well, it's pretty crazy. I mean, even I would say, you know, 15 years ago, a lot of this wasn't available. So
no.
We can see before our very eyes just how rapidly things right. change. And so that brings us to talk about critical thinking and collaboration and communication and the 21st century soft skills that are so necessary. And how do you see all the things that you're doing, these pieces of these soft skills kind of coming together to advance your students?
Well, it's sad that they call them soft skills because I think they're essential skills.
Yeah.
And so I like to call them essential skills. But there are fancy words for the skills that business people and are looking for in our kids, and you can't teach that in a textbook. The Haunted School Project, that was a Shark Tank activity we did in community development that all came from the kids. And we had business people who came in and they pitched their Shark Tank ideas to the sharks, and they picked which project we'd implement and fund. And so that all came from the kids. You know, so right there, critical thinking, what's the need in our community? What do we do? What can we do in our time frame? What can we afford to do? Who can we work with to make this happen? And that was all students. They don't see it's happening. I don't think they've ever said, oh my gosh, I learned so much problem solving in that activity. But they will later. It's always been said as teachers, we have to prepare kids for jobs that aren't even created mm-hmm. yet. We can prepare them with the skills that they will use in those jobs.
There gets to a point probably in everything you do where there's a bit of fatigue or the obstacle seems too challenging to climb. Tegan, is there any specific project that comes to mind where you had what seemed like maybe an insurmountable challenge that together you were able to overcome?
We got asked to build a gazebo, I don't know, 4 years ago. And we built it all out of green treat lumber, and it was beautiful and heavy. And no one measured the door, and it didn't fit out.
Oh, no.
Do you want to talk about the money it would have cost us to send all the supplies to Texas?
I honestly don't know the amount.
It was $600.
Yes.
To send it. So what did we do instead?
We found another school that was all driving down their own supplies. So we asked them, and they were kind enough to take our many, many boxes along with theirs in the bus or van.
Yeah, because we were playing them, wasn't it a volleyball game? So they happened mm-hmm. to come up, and they were playing us for a school event, and they're like, yeah, we can take those boxes down, load them in our bus. And yeah, they did. They were just willing to do it. Chapters around us, we all worked mm-hmm. together.
No matter what you plan for, there's going to be something that arises. And it's really fun when it all works out, and then we're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But in the moment, we were maybe freaking out about sending $600 worth of supplies down there. It's all about the teamwork. And
that's what employers are looking for, people that are willing to figure things out and the stick-to-itiveness and not just throw their hands up in the air and yep. walk out the door. Well, and Tegan and Shelby, maybe just from you, and maybe this is just a little bit different way to look at it, but maybe tell me if you can, imagining your high school careers without these service learning projects, maybe as a way to tell me how important they are to your education.
For sure, they're super important. Like looking back, if I wouldn't have went to Nationals and spoke about our Wildcats wandering the world and we didn't do that, I probably wouldn't even be going into the career I am, because I learned about it over the Skype call that we had during Wildcats wandering the world. So everything happens for a reason. And yeah, if you can get involved in some of these things that we do in our chapter, like it's a very good opportunity.
I think that all these service projects have really helped me. They've helped me prepare for this project that I'm creating now, just like remembering what they all, like the steps that took into it, just when we actually got the project. I know there are a lot of steps that would have taken up to actually preparing and getting the project done the day of. So I think the past projects have helped me prepare for this one.
Well, Nikki and Tegan and Shelby, thanks for having me here in Center.
Yes, thank you.
Cutting Edge podcast host Tom Gerhart talking with Center High School teacher Nikki Dahl and her students Tegan Henke and Shelby Meckley. Dakota Datebook is next.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents an evening of classics at their 93rd season finale on Saturday, April 27th at MSU's Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. Enjoy Beethoven's Triple Concerto featuring Minot's own luminist, Dr. John Rumney on violin, Dr. Diana Anderson on piano, and Dr. Eric Anderson on cello. Other classic favorites include Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Espanol and Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. Tickets available online at MinotSymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4222.
Everyone's living on social media these days. And hey, so is Prairie Public.
Me love when friends come to visit.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and
Twitter
at Prairie Public.
They take pictures of themselves, and no surprise, they post them to Instagram.
You'll find television and radio content and behind-the-scenes views of Prairie Public via Facebook Live.
While we're live on Facebook, time for another movie review with Madeline.
Interact by sharing your thoughts, opinions, and photos. Just not your cat photos.
Talk to Prairie Public. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 24th. On this date in 1914, the Washburn Leader newspaper explained that the town of Washburn had a rather inauspicious beginning. In the summer of 1882, the steamer Rosebud was in Bismarck loading for a trip to Fort Benton. Waiting to be placed on board was a square white box addressed for delivery in Washburn. The clerk initially refused to receive the box to allow it to be loaded. The reason was simple. No one knew where Washburn was. Neither the clerk nor anyone else on the docks had ever heard of it. The crew finally agreed to accept the cargo, but it rowed to Fort Benton and back and seemed to have found a home on the Rosebud. One morning, the whistle blew, and the clerk was called up on deck. He wanted to know if there was a problem. The pilot pointed to the riverbank and said, "There's your darn town of Washburn." And sure enough, there it was. Nailed to two big trees was a white sign with hand-painted black lettering that read, "Washburn." So the steamboat landed. A man came down to the river and offered to take possession of the box. The mystery of Washburn was solved when he explained that the sign hadn't been nailed in place until the steamboat had already passed by on the first trip. When the box was offloaded, it tipped over and the contents spilled out. It was a full-sized, old-fashioned spinning wheel shipped all the way from the old country. It was, in fact, the cause of a bitter family dispute. Two sisters were fighting over who could keep that family heirloom. The man who paid for the sign was the town's founder, John Satterland. Founded in 1882, Washburn is the oldest city in McLean County. It became the county seat in 1883. It's named for General Cadwallader C. Washburn, a prominent soldier and businessman. He had also been a congressman and the governor of Wisconsin. Satterland had known Washburn and named the new town in his honor. Today, Washburn is home to the North Dakota Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center, and it offers many leisure opportunities, including biking, hiking, hunting, fishing, and boating. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll talk with Joe Wiegand about his long-running role impersonating Theodore Roosevelt at Medora. Wiegand is developing a new version of his popular show. Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats to talk about raising chickens in the backyard. Madeline will review the Mustang and will share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.